Welcome back. That's Nine Inch Nails, March of the Pigs. Robin Finck of Nine Inch Nails was born on this day in 1971.
And you're listening to an archived edition of the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. Now back to our segment.
It's my pleasure this hour to talk with a man who I've known for a while, I guess since the existence of this program almost, when he came out with his other books in this trilogy. We're talking, of course, by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Taylor Branch, who wrote The Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 63 and 65, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 54 to 63, and At Canaan's Edge, of course, Parting the Waters was the first book that won the Pulitzer for him, and At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, the final book in this trilogy, 65 to 68. And Taylor, welcome. Pleasure to have you in the studio.
I'm glad to be here at last.
At last. Free at last.
Free at last.
Congratulations on finishing the trilogy.
Thank you.
You finished this trilogy. I think just a little background here before we dive into your book. You started this trilogy 24, 25 years ago?
1982.
And you thought it was going to be this one volume at first, from what I've read. We've never talked about this, but turned into this work of 23 years worth of writing and work. I mean, how did that happen, that you started out with this one thought and then it just turned into this voluminous piece?
Well, the context of it was that it was proposed to be a one-volume work that would take 3 years, which was three times longer than I'd ever spent on any other book before mm-hmm. that. So I knew it was a big project, and it was defined from the beginning as America in the King Years, a storytelling recreation of the civil rights era. So my own definition is what really set in motion the formula for a much bigger book even than I conceived, because, I had this rule that I think in race relations we learn by stories that are human more than by ideas that are abstract, and that most of the labels in racial discussion of militant and racist and all that stuff really don't convey anything except people's sense of their own well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to do storytelling, and I knew it would take a lot longer. But I had no notion that I was going to have to do so much education in order to be able to...
Your own education, you mean?
Of myself.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to present things from as many different points of view as came to bear in the movement. You know, people were at each other's throats over the meaning of freedom right from the beginning. And people of so many different kinds, you know, bishops and presidents and FBI directors and sharecroppers. And terrified people. This book starts out in, you know,
in Lowndes County, Alabama.
Yeah, people terrified because there's a rumor that if the preacher shows up and even mentions the vote, the Klan's going to come in the church to get him. And they do. That world, you know, is pretty far away from most of us. And to be able to tell it from the point of view of the people who are in it means you've got to do a lot of work that's not in libraries. Because libraries, my theory is libraries preserve what people are comfortable with. And we're not comfortable with any of this. So I had to do a lot of interviews and, you know, a lot of archival work. So it just kept expanding into religion and into politics, but most of all into the lives of human beings in really deep struggle.
People have called this the King biography, but I think that's a real misnomer. It's much more. I mean, King is the centerpiece, but it's not a book just about the biography of Martin Luther King.
Oh, absolutely not. Even in the proposal, I said I wanted to do people that I admired, like Bob Moses of SNCC, and certainly the presidents, Kennedy and Johnson, because this era comprises Vietnam, encompasses Vietnam, and huge wars and that sort of thing. So there are lots and lots of other characters, but. The preface to Parting the Waters, I still stand by. It said, you know, this is not strictly speaking a biography. It's a narrative history of America during this time, which I think was defined mostly by the civil rights movement and King at its center, not always at its head, but always mm-hmm. at its center, in the sense that people, even who are ahead of him, trying to get him to go on the freedom rides, are pitching for his ear. And the people who hate him, like J. Edgar Hoover, are trying to figure out how to undo him. So he's in the middle of the wheel.
Now, it's amazing to me that just always jumps out at me again when I was reading the book, that the period of time we're talking about with Martin Luther King and the period you look at in American history was 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're saying to us in some ways in this book, that these may be 13 of the most pivotal years in American history, in the American world.
Oh, I think so, and it's just so uncanny that that these 13 years coincide exactly. I mean, he takes his first church and he launches his career just before it began, just before the bus boycott happens. And then by the time he's dead, really the movement is in disintegration. But it has set all these things in motion that I think are still coming to the fore for today in empirical life, in movements about what equal rights really mean that affected women and who washes dishes and who's on TV and who's treated fairly and who gets to vote and all these other things.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute before we come back to the heart of the book. I mean, what do you think it was about that era? What do you think it set in motion that we're still wrestling with today? What are the things that you've come to from writing this book when you look at 2005?
Well, I think it comes out of World War II. It comes out of American history. It comes out of the American Revolution. What does freedom mean? I think that's the only story there is in America. What does freedom mean, and are we true to it or not? And how do you run a government that way? And World War II was all about that and race and fighting the Nazis and that sort of thing. And it raised all of the racial issues to a new height. Can we say we are defending freedom against the Nazis and then reimpose segregation at home, which is how the Brown decision was ultimately decided and struggle of all that. And that intellectually put segregation outside the realm of American ideology. And yet it was embedded in everyday life. You wake up the next morning, it's still segregated. So what do you do about it? And I think that really kind of set off all of this struggle. But once people start struggling with what's the nature of equal citizenship, why have we never had a female Episcopal priest? You know, people started struggling in all these. Why can't women go to Princeton? You know, that's in these hearings today.
Right.
And it's so well decided now that people think it's a ridiculous issue. But if it were so ridiculous, it would have happened 100 years ago. And, and you know, during this period, it was still a very dubious proposition that women of any race should attend most of the private colleges in the United States, should be allowed to go. And they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that question in a different way. On a liberal tide that is still kind of lapping up on the shores when liberal is not even a polite word in public society.
People run from the word.
So you have these hearings today with the guy saying, well, gosh, I can barely remember that. Well, yes, you can barely remember that. But there was a time when it was a hot issue in the United States, and even when churches came to the brink of schism over whether or not they were going to allow females to hold office in the church. Now it's gays. You know, that's gay people. So we've moved, still struggling about what's the nature of equal rights and how do you treat people and fairness as a legacy of the civil rights struggle, in my view.
My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize winning author Taylor Branch, who's finished his last in his trilogy called At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years. This volume, 1965 to 1968. I want to jump to the middle of the book, and because you talked about freedom, and you have a chapter in your book that talks about how the symbols of liberty began to change in America.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to go back and talk about what led up to that, but I mean, and you're talking about in 1967 is when this chapter started.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about Meredith and South and Reagan and Nixon and the whole question of race in the South, and how that began to change the notions. And we see the reverberations of that with Democrats and Republicans and who's in power today. But you clearly saw that as a very pivotal moment.
Yeah, it was 66, actually, the year that Reagan was elected governor. And June of 66 and the Meredith March and the rise of Black Power. The official position, and not just of Nixon and Reagan, but of a lot of white people, beginning in that year, was that the race issue was done.
Right.
That was settled and that there was no political future in it. Now, of course, America was still segregated then, and there were enormous struggles over how to enforce it. And they had just begun to enforce the desegregation by sex of American jobs. The want ads in American newspapers were still help wanted male, help wanted female.
That's right. That's right.
And people forget that. And they had just been struggling to get rid of the help wanted white and help wanted colored or black and Negro in other areas. But we were so eager because it was an uncomfortable and politically difficult issue, and particularly because the new Republican Party in the South, which had never really existed and was springing up in opposition to civil rights, they couldn't try to reimpose segregation, but what they did was to say that the end of segregation was done and that it was a burden on the South and that it was a lesson against overreaching big government. Nixon's position was that the race issue is over and done. There's no future for either party, and the lesson is that the Democratic Party endangered the nation by getting too involved in the issue of race, which, of course, is exactly what Lyndon Johnson had feared when he signed the two Civil Rights Acts. Mm-hmm. I'm giving the South to the Republicans who don't even exist in the South, not only for my lifetime, but maybe for yours.
He knew that.
He said to Bill Moyers. Yeah. And he did it anyway, which I think is one measure of Lyndon Johnson that I believe shines through in this book. He was very sincere about what he did. He knew he was risking his political future there.
You delve deeply into the characters of both Martin Luther King and Lyndon Baines Johnson. I mean, really kind of looked at these men in all their complexity, which got some people angry at you. We'll talk about in a bit about the King parts. But it was also Johnson's complexity. I told you that when I read the Selma speech and that you can describe here from in a moment, it blew my mind to read that again because I think a lot of us back then, at least I was, so busy vilifying Johnson in the early 60s and 64 and 65, not to think of the complexity of this man and what he wrestled with. And I think that's something that might have been eye-opening to you as well as you kind of looked at this book and
It was eye-opening to look at the background of him preparing. First of all, the speech, the eloquence of the speech itself will speak for itself. It is an unbelievably eloquent speech when he says, "We shall overcome." But before he says that, I speak for the dignity of man, you know. But the background of it and how consciously he realized he was putting his presidency on the line and how he knew it was going to change the partisan structure of politics in the whole United States, and he did it anyway. And the reasons he did that are pretty amazing. He was so sure-footed on the subtleties of how to extend liberty for the fundamental right to vote that's at the heart of the American promise, and so eloquent that when he then, in the very same month, sends 50,000 Marines to Vietnam, knowing that he's likely to have stalemate, predicting that it's going to take 500,000 soldiers and win at best stalemate, and that he doesn't want to do it and it makes chills run up and down my spine, but he does it anyway because he said the American people will forgive you for anything but being weak and they'll run you out of office if you're a coward, so I've got to do it. It's a very, very complex portrait because I think he felt freedom much more deeply. His formative experiences as a teacher of Mexican American student in Texas back in the 1920s, really stayed with him in a way that I think most people's formative experiences do. I wonder where George Bush's formative experiences were in the Vietnam era, because that's the era of civil rights and this. So, but the corresponding personal, deep personal feelings of Johnson stunned me in the book. They also make me very thankful for the record that we have of his private telephone conversations and sad that we won't have those for current presidents because eventually those historical records, in Johnson's case, allow you to humanize government struggling with very deep issues and see them as real people.
I mean, the idea that you're talking about, when he made this speech, we're talking about it was right around Selma,
mm-hmm.
and the struggle over the vote and the battles and his own interpersonal battles with Martin Luther King,
right,
which were just amazing.
Right, and George Wallace. He just met with King and Wallace at the same time. Not at the same time, but I mean in the same
moment.
Week.
Yeah.
They're, same historical moment, and people think that he's going to have to send in the army to do this, and the Southern senators are saying to establish the right to vote down there will be a revolution, and we will rise up in the streets, and you will have to be a totalitarian dictator, and the economy will shrivel up, and the average garden variety American white American won't have a chance. And our economy will shrivel. And he's saying, no, we have to do it anyway. And when he said we shall overcome, it was a jaw-dropping moment in American history. I mean, people in the Congress started cussing and not knowing what was going on. The mayor of Selma said every Southerner felt stabbed in the back. because
every white Southerner
that a Southern president would adopt the slogan of the civil rights movement on national television from the well of the Congress, and not just as a rhetorical advice. This was about landmark legislation that would take away from the states the right to govern who voted, who registered to vote. And basically it did that. It gave the vote to 5 million new black voters in the South.
And on the same time, as you talked about in terms of Vietnam, he was escalating a war, even though, as you described in the book, he wrestled with these moral issues himself and knew what he was doing was wrong, but he did it. Blows your mind when you read that, when he knew what he was doing would have ended up killing millions of people for no reason.
Right. And, you know, he's even talking with some of the same people about doing both of them, which is with McNamara, because McNamara, should we send troops in the South to enforce voting rights? And they say no, because it will offend the Southerners and it will do you more harm than good. It will provoke people. It will offend. So he's very sure-footed on the subtleties of the relationship between violence and power and democracy at home. But overseas, he knows that he's not going to be able to establish a political order among the Vietnamese, but he believes that violence will prevent the communists, hold off the communists from consolidating their control. And he says, if I don't do that, they'll call me a chicken and run me out of office. And he does it anyway.
Let's turn to Martin Luther King and his complexities as we talk to Taylor Branch about the final book in his trilogy on the King Years, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 65 through 68. Now, you delved into the lives of both Johnson and King. Some I've read have begun to criticize you in this book for painting the complexities of Martin Luther King, the man, and in his struggles as a man and some of the affairs he had. Now, when I heard those and I was reading through the book and trying to find them, and it's not as if you've kind of laced the book with King's affairs. I mean, you have to kind of find them buried in the pages where you kind of allude to things, except for that one piece about Coretta King, his wife, when he announced when she was ill about this affair he had had. But so people criticize, A, why do you have to make that known? B, why was it important to the book? And what does it say to you about King the man and how it doesn't seem to blur for you the power he had as one of the most powerful figures in American history?
Well, King the man is real, and that's the truth. And King the man is really struggling. And in fact, as Coretta herself said, he was a guilt-driven man his whole life. And various forms of guilt affect people in different ways. I don't pretend to know, but I think there's a lot of evidence in King that one of the driving forces in his public life was almost to do penance for his. He said right from the pulpit, "I'm not the saint everybody says I am. I'm a man just like you are." But lots of people in history have given us role models to believe that we can redeem ourselves. You know, St. Augustine, Martin Luther, Paul Tillich. He cited an awful lot of great figures in religious history who had their own private demons about sex and their inabilities to control them and that sort of thing, and who somehow worked them out or compensated on a large stage to try to do the best they could. And I think there's a lot of evidence that that's what King did too. Certainly, I tried to be selective about where it came in and used this when it was an issue in his life, when he felt that he was jeopardizing the movement and in his private discussions was trying to use this, was trying to protect the movement. And of course, you know, you can't be honest about the FBI trying to blackmail King if you're not honest about King having something to be blackmailed for. So, honesty of a very difficult subject is not just a two-way street; it's a 15-way street with King at the middle of the target here. Now, I thought when I started the book that King was wrong to do the Poor People's Campaign at the end of his life, as opposed to doing what Bevel wanted him to do and Joan Baez and many others wanted him to do, which was to do an all-out march on Washington to shut it down until they end the Vietnam War. He wanted to do the Poor People's Campaign, and it was the last great decision that he made. If I had ever had a chance to interview him, that's the one thing I would have asked first. But King, they had this huge debate, and I came at it from the standpoint of a former college student who was in the anti-war movement, and we thought that was the most important thing in ending the war, which is what a big, huge faction in the movement was felt. But King ultimately decided that as important as ending the war was, that essentially it was polarizing, but of course everything was polarizing, but it was a negative message to government to stop doing what you're doing. And that's all it could ever be, and that he felt that the Poor People's Campaign reverted to the theme of the civil rights movement, that we can rise up and live out the meaning of the American creed through our national politics by tackling problems of liberty that are deemed to be impossible, and that segregation was one, voting rights was one, the freedom rights, they were all appeals to the government to answer these searing problems with, you know, put them in the hamper of liberty and deal with them. And he decided that the Poor People's Campaign was in that tradition, and that even if he didn't have a chance of winning the battles then, that it would be a legacy that we're going to, you know, we believe we can address poverty, too. We can, I believe that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed and work a miracle with poverty, too.
Well, Taylor, when you get so deeply into the nuances of the interpolitical, interpersonal battles around King and around Johnson, and you can see what they were arguing about and what they argued about over the war in Vietnam, the arguments over segregation, the arguments over how to fight for freedom in America. What do you think it does to you and then to us, because we read what you write, about the what those nuances do, about our how they change our view of the world, but they change your view of the world? I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing when you have this larger view of history and see, you know, civil rights struggle, Johnson, the war.
Mm-hmm.
But you're seeing the nuances here. You're seeing the really horrid, sometimes interesting battles around Martin Luther King that took place. The same thing around Johnson and the war and civil rights. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are vicious debates and fights that took place internally as people. What did that do to you to understand all of that and for us to understand all of that?
It enthralls me to be an American. It makes me feel lucky, even though there's so much, there's a lot of cruelty and freedom, and there's no guarantee that we can keep freedom. But to see people struggling with it at that level of detail, to me, is the best part of our birthright. And it makes me sad that we don't do the same thing now. Most people are passive, or they see politics as entertainment or cynicism. Just as something, but it really affects everyday life. I mean, the South used to be a place where terrorism was quite prevalent and omnipresent in when it wasn't as a threat. It was a different place. You were afraid if you saw an integrated meeting that violence was not far away.
Mm-hmm.
That everyday life is so far removed. What to me is sad is that we take that for granted and don't realize that that came about from everyday struggle, people struggling over this. That's nonviolence. That's what democracy is made of.
And that's the core for you, this nonviolent piece of it is core for you.
Oh, absolutely. And it was the most powerful idea in the civil rights movement and the first one to become passé, the first one to be ridiculed across the board, starting with Malcolm X from the left. You know, nonviolence is for children and sissies. But then by everybody else, and it was repudiated by Black Power. Stokely Carmichael repudiated nonviolence after going to jail nonviolently for 6 years to win the right to vote. And then he, sadly to me, repudiated the right to vote, having sacrificed almost as much as anybody. I mean, Stokely in Lowndes County, to me, is the most poignant story in the whole book.
I agree.
In some respects, because he suffered so much. It took so much guts to go in there where no Black person had voted in the whole 20th century, where you couldn't even talk about voting without risking your life. And he survived a year. In 1 year, he took these people and inspired them not only to register to vote, but to learn the offices and even want to run for office.
And they almost won.
And
they came
almost
close to
win. And they almost won in 1966, the first time they ever voted. And he got no credit for that, and he was attacked for doing it. He was seen as because he didn't want to do it in the Democratic Party as sectarian and this, that, and the other. And it was very sad to see him finally revolt.
Taylor, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 65 through 68. We'll come back to Taylor and more of this in the near future.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes.
On our way out of here, we're here in California by the great Joni Mitchell, who was born on this day in 1943.
And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.